Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast at peterbcollins.com. Steve Horn has been reporting on this podcast for years about environmental issues, and he recently shifted to a new focus. He reports for criminal legal news and prison legal news, and in today's episode, he talks about the recent investigation of the Golden State Killer, which was enabled by devious use of police tactics in accessing online genealogical sites. And they use the DNA of the cousin of the suspected killer to track down suspect Joseph DeAngelo. It raises a host of questions about the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, new police evidence gathering tactics and techniques, and our shredded privacy rights. This podcast is made possible by people like you who support my work with subscriptions, including the fine folks at Technical Support Cooperative, Benny Alto in Oregon, William Janetta, and the ever-loyal Teresa Paris. I'd like you to join their ranks. Visit peterbcollins.com, find the menu tab, and click on Become a Subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page, and in just a couple of minutes, you can set up a subscription to help support my work. For decades here in California, there was a killer on the loose. Authorities have tracked down a suspect, Joseph DeAngelo, who they believe committed a dozen murders and as many as 50 rapes across California in the 1970s and the 1980s. But how did they do it? And is your DNA secure if you have served it up to a genealogy website? These are questions we'll explore today. Thin Lizzy opens the podcast today from an ancient album called Chinatown. It's called Killer on the Loose. Steve Horn is a talented young journalist who spent many years covering the environmental and climate change beat. He became an expert on pipelines in America, and now he has shifted his focus. He is working as a reporter for prison legal news and criminal legal news, and he returns to our podcast today. Steve, great to have you again.
Good to be back on. Thanks for having me, Peter.
You bet. And I am really thrilled at the work that you've decided to focus on, at least at this stage of your career as a reporter, because for a long time I've been interested in the issues related to prisons and prisoners, the criminal justice system. I've been active in a nonprofit organization based at San Quentin Prison since the 1980s, and I've advocated for individual prisoners, many of whom have been released on parole. So later on, I want to talk about what motivated you to shift your focus. But you've written a piece about the Golden State Killer and about the backstory of how the authorities tracked down this central player, they believe, in so many cold cases. And on one hand, I'm pleased that the detective work has paid off. I am awaiting evidence from some of the suspected crimes that are being attributed to him, because I think some district attorneys are trying to kind of clear the docket, given this opportunity. At the same time, the law enforcement tactics that were used here raise some important questions, and you've written a piece about it recently. So why don't you begin by telling us what you think the central concerns are about detectives using these genealogical websites that people voluntarily contribute their own DNA to?
Yeah, well, I think that the central concern raised by civil libertarians and criminal justice reform organizations, it mostly centers around the same thing that we hear with Facebook or Twitter or other social media sites. That is, in some ways, you could say it's almost, sadly to say, it's the fault of the user, that the user didn't read the terms and conditions, but who does read those, which raises the bigger question is, if you didn't read it, you might not have realized that within those terms and conditions, it basically has a line item within it on all these sites, including the one that GED Match is the website, GEDmatch.com. And that particular website is the one where, by cross-referencing a DNA sample from a distant relative of the Golden State Killer, law enforcement was able to, using other techniques, match that with what was on the website to track down the suspect known as the Golden State Killer, Joseph James DeAngelo. I think the concern is that that distant family member or others like that distant family member may not have realized that by putting their DNA up on the website that they are opening the door for future potential criminal probes. And it's kind of a new use of those sites that we know of, at least, although I guess there's a chance that there were lower profile ones that where this has taken place. I'm not 100% sure if this was the very first example, but I think the big takeaway is that regardless, it's now being used in for subsequent ones, such as an example that I wrote about in Washington State for another high profile double murder that took place there, where that suspect has been arrested and is now going to be go up for trial. And then I think in my article I also raised that there's a lab based in Virginia that has said that they have 100 more cases that they're now investigating using DNA samples that they're uploading to that same website, GED Match. And they just told the TV, I guess, outlet and also online news website Oxygen that they think that 20% of those samples will, just those alone, will lead to the arrest because they're such good matches, and then 30% more with corroboration work with law enforcement, 30% more can be solved. So we're talking about potentially 50 more in the pipelines that can be solved using these techniques, and it still raises the big question. Is this what people really signed up for? Did they want to get ensnared in these criminal justice probes? Because, of course, they're going to have to be, if you uploaded your stuff to these sites, you're going to now be directly involved in the case because it was your DNA that you uploaded. So it raises questions. And, I think I want to say one more thing, and that's that in the aftermath of this, publication, there's a publication that released a story, Fast Company, the magazine and online news publication, that they reported that the FTC, they did a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, to get information on if they were doing any sorts of investigations, the Federal Trade Commission, on this issue. And in return, they actually, they sort of basically revealed that they are looking into this because they couldn't release any records because they are now doing ongoing investigations. So it's definitely an issue that the federal government is now looking at. Maybe there'll be limits on what law enforcement can do, maybe not, but it's definitely been raised as a societal issue, and it's now gone up to the FTC, see what they do about it. But probably more broadly, we'll see maybe the Department of Justice look at guidelines, et cetera, as we go forward. This is still a new developing issue.
Well, I also expect lawsuits based on Fourth and Fifth Amendment issues. And,
right.
And we'll delve a little deeper into that. First, let's just thumbnail the case before us here. Joe DeAngelo was a police officer in a little community in the Sierra Nevada hills up near Lake Tahoe back in the 1970s. He was fired from that job. And as we piece together his activities after that, based on the evidence that was used to find him, they accuse him of 12 murders, 50 rapes, and many burglaries, as mm-hmm. many as 100 that may have occurred.
Yeah, 120, yep.
And so, so on the one hand, we can applaud law enforcement for really being persistent and not giving up on what appeared to be a series of cold cases that were getting colder by the year. Mm-hmm. I don't deny law enforcement the opportunity to update their tactics and their methods using new technology, and criminals have to expect that. We also have laws that don't reflect the development of the internet and DNA testing and people who share their information with an expectation of privacy, even if it was a misguided expectation based, as you cited, on the privacy notification that nobody reads when you sign up at a new website. So, you know, on the face of this, this is a great success and shows that law enforcement has adapted to this new technological environment. But it also raises a number of sensitive issues because, as we have learned, they went to GED Match where they used a certain level of deception. They created a profile under a fake name, and they used that to connect to a distant relative of D'Angelo. Then, with that fueling their suspicions, they went to pick up confirming DNA by picking up his garbage and, I guess, some Kleenex or you know, something like that, where they were able to get his DNA in order to make a positive match to the DNA evidence from some of these crime scenes. So, you know, this does raise issues about their methods and about the protections that people should enjoy from, you know, having a distant family member participate in a genealogical website. So tell me your thoughts and what you've picked up in your reporting from civil liberties advocates.
Well, I think that the main concern that they raise is that this is, of course, an example of a high-profile, really violent criminal suspect in the Golden State Killer, or Joseph James DeAngelo. But the concern is that this could be used in a way that's for, you know, more petty-type crimes and maybe, you know, crimes that maybe didn't really need to be prosecuted. And it just is opening up a big sort of a wide web, you could say. It's unclear if this will, for now, it's these cold cases that seem to be centered around high-profile names, you know, people like the Golden State Killer, the Zodiac Killer, for example, which is another California
mm-hmm. San Francisco, yeah.
Right, yeah, and then there's the one in Washington that I discussed. His name is Ray Earl Talbot, which is pretty high-profile in that area in Washington State, so there's those examples. Zodiac Killer, I should make clear, there's no leads yet, but it's just kind of been speculation that maybe these same techniques could solve that cold case and figure out who that individual
Steve,
was.
Let me pick up on something you said here, because it triggered the events of the investigation into the San Bernardino events a few years ago. And, you know, James Comey, as the FBI director, kept demanding that Apple open the work iPhone of the male shooter, of the couple there, and saying, you know, that this is a very critical case, we've got to get this information. And from the get-go, nobody had alleged that there was anything important on this guy's work iPhone. And this was being used, I believe, by the FBI because they could wedge with this high-profile case that so many people were outraged about and say, well, look, you know, how can you justify keeping an iPhone locked when it might open up information about another terrorism event? And so I'm very wary of the use of these cases. And certainly, you know, I want to see whoever the Golden State Killer was brought to justice. At the same time, I want to protect the rights of innocent individuals, and I also want to protect people from wrongful accusation and conviction.
Right, and you know, there's just the big thing that I think, you know, the number one issue here is that going back to the uploading of these DNA samples on the websites, this is not information that law enforcement would necessarily have had access to via normal search or data retention methods that law enforcement has at its fingertips. Excuse the pun there. But, you know, I think that that's the big issue is do they have the Fourth, Fifth Amendment rights to be going to these websites and regularly tapping into them where, you know, these are not DNA samples necessarily that they would have had otherwise. So I think that there's definitely going to be, you know, this is going to be litigated, I think, for years to come in terms of what the scope of what they're allowed to do is if these websites, and then again, if these websites have terms and conditions that comply with that. So I think that there's going to be a give and take between, you know, justice departments, law enforcement agencies, and also these particular websites. So this is still very much an emerging issue. It's gone very high on the public profile because of this big cold case that they think they've solved in the Golden State Killer. But yeah, I think that we're seeing the very start of this conversation rather than anything near the end. And I think that, like I said, it will be litigated, you know, limited or maybe expanded, give and take for years to come.
Well, and Steve, I'm interested in seeing a level playing field here. And by that, I mean that these methods can also be used for exculpatory outcomes, that you can clear someone who has been alleged to have been involved in a specific crime by pursuing this, you know, very accurate information that can be developed from DNA. And let me just take a quick tangent here. On June 7th, I posted in my daily news and comment podcast a link to a New York Times video analysis of the police killing of Stephon Clark. Is that his name? Stephon? Yeah, Clark.
Yeah, you got it.
In Sacramento. And it's fascinating to see because in this case, the body cam footage and also footage from the police helicopter that was hovering over the scene presents a very compelling case of the clear overreaction of the cops and the unnecessary shooting to kill of Stephon Clark, because the first two shots to his leg did cause him to fall. He was no threat to the officers, but there was another round, a barrage of gunfire, 5 to 8 shots, many of which did hit Stephon Clark. My point is that this is evidence from the police body cams that will allow us to analyze the actions of the officers, and I hope that they will be disciplined or fired for the way that they deprived this man of his life unnecessarily. But I also want to share the flip side of that, that last year I served on a jury. And the case before us was a guy who had a fast motorcycle, and he evaded the police for over an hour and speeds up to 150 miles an hour. And the evidence that we saw in the jury was almost exclusively from video shot on dash cams, on body cams, from police aircraft. And it was very compelling, and we did convict him. And so I point this out so that people understand the technology and these new digital tools are very heavily used by law enforcement today, and many of us believe that their greatest value is in protecting us from a bad act by a bad actor who happens to have a badge. But they're also collecting a lot of this video and other evidence that is successfully used in prosecutions.
Yeah, right, yeah. No, I think you raise that's a really interesting point that you raised early on just now about the fact that, we're talking about being used for criminal convictions in criminal courts, whether it's federal or state But yeah, there's still the, you know, there's the opportunity that maybe it could be flipped on its head, and this could be used for, as you said, exculpatory purposes. That hasn't happened yet. Doesn't mean it won't. Maybe criminal defense attorneys will start doing the same thing, where they send it to that, you know, the type of lab that I mentioned in Virginia by the name of Parabon Nano Labs or labs like that, and it can be used as part of defense to potentially clear wrongfully convicted individuals who are currently incarcerated. So I think that it's, like I said, it's still very early. It's only basically these two cases, the one in Washington and the California one, where it's been used for the purposes of arrests and criminal cases. But I expect it to go both ways in the years to come. So it's not only the takeaway of my article was that it's in one sense that it's something that individuals should be wary of when they do upload their DNA to these sites, and that, you know, this could happen to you. You never know who your distant relative is, for example, or, you know, you may have no idea who they are, or what crimes they may have committed, and you may become sort of ensnared in these sorts of things as part of criminal investigations. So there's that side of it, and then there's also the side of it that maybe that very same evidence, that DNA evidence, could be used to clear someone, or, you know, make a trial more murky and less cut and dry than it maybe have been. And then there's another thing I just want to raise, and that's, although I haven't, this wasn't in the article that I wrote, but DNA, although it is like one of the better sources of evidence, maybe one of the best, it's not foolproof by any means. There's definitely been scholarship recently that shows that it's not, you know, that there can be errors found in DNA, or it's just not as cut and dry as it may seem. Mm-hmm. So that's also an issue that goes into this whole thing, is DNA as foolproof as it's been made out to be? Of course, it is still one of the best methods in terms of accuracy, but it's not 100, doesn't have 100% rate, and there's definitely ongoing scholarship about that, both in the, you know, in the criminal justice sphere, but more broadly by those who study DNA and DNA samples.
Well, first of all, the quality of any evidence is affected by the chain of custody, the reliability of the person who collected the evidence, and the methods that were used to preserve it and keep it from becoming tainted. And, you know, getting a clean sample of someone's DNA is not as simple as getting them to spit in a test tube or give a blood sample. It really varies. And we've seen, for example, that for years, the FBI would send its agents as professional witnesses to testify against criminal defendants, and they would argue that their fingerprint tracking and matching systems were 98% or something like that. They would make outrageous claims. And in recent years, we've seen that fingerprinting is not nearly as accurate an identification system as we were told for decades.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's a related issue, but yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think that I just wrote an article that touched on that very issue. There's a it hasn't been published yet, I don't believe, but it's there's a paper that was written by a law professor at University of Virginia, Brandon Garrett, and basically that's the crux of his article is, the people who are doing any of this work, which is often, you know, experts in the field or so-called experts, expert witnesses, as when it comes to the criminal trial, what he was calling for is these people need to be held more to the scientific method. They need to be able to really explain in depth in court. They should have to, at least, the step-by-step processes through which they did their work, so bringing the scientific method to courts rather than bringing them into a court and them just saying, well, I have, you know, 15 years of experience and I'm an expert in this field, so just sort of trust me, I'm an expert. So
yeah, I'm from Quantico and we've never been wrong.
Right, exactly, yeah. So, he's calling, that was a paper that just came out that he published, and he's moving to Duke University, but yeah, Brendan Garrett's work on criminal defense and wrongful convictions, and also he's done some good work on the lack of convictions when it comes to corporate crime. So, yeah, I would recommend listeners check out his new paper on the issue of expert witnesses.
Now, Steve, I can hear some people, even in my skeptical and aware audience, saying, well, look, I didn't kill anybody. I don't have anything to hide. So why should I care if the police bend the rules or, use phony methods to access a genealogical website where they find out that somebody related to me committed a crime? So you have some interesting quotes in your article here, one from Vera Eidelman of the ACLU. People may not be so troubled by such an intrusion when it comes to a serial killer, but imagine the implications of using this technique for shoplifters or trespassers. The lines we draw for this case may well provide a roadmap for investigations of crimes in the future, and the techniques used here are likely only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to what investigators will soon have the technological power to do. And I think this is a very important cautionary note, because there are many people who just blithely say, I don't care about Stingray because I don't have anything private or criminal on my cell phone, so if the FBI intercepts that, so what? And we're living in an era of such erosion of privacy that many people have just generally given up and said, well, even if I try to protect my privacy, Google knows every keystroke that I enter on my computer.
Yeah, well, it's two things there. So there's the issue of privacy. There's the issue of what can this be used for. We'll start with the issue of privacy, and that there's another quote in the article that I think is, and we touched on it already, and that is how wise is it to, one thing is Facebook or Google or social media sites which people use, and okay, yeah, they're going to know some basic information about you because you gave it away. And I think most people at this point know that there's no pure privacy. You're not going to have as much privacy anymore far less privacy once you start using these social media sites or get a Gmail account or what have you. Basically, once you're an internet user, you definitely start losing significant amounts of privacy. Then there's the bigger issue of, is it smart to do something as personal as upload your DNA to these sites? GED Match, for example, that's an actual open source site, so you have to have an account. But once you do that, pretty much anyone can go on that site, whether in this case it was law enforcement, and find matches. Whereas these other sites, there's other competitor sites that aren't open source, so there's some more privacy, at least in that it'd be harder for law enforcement to get access to it. They would need a subpoena or something similar to compel the production of that DNA data. So it was an issue of that website in particular, GED Match, which is the main one that has now become a go-to in the not only the Golden State Killer case, but also the Ray Earl Talbot case that I mentioned. And as I said, that there's at least 100 other that they've admitted that the lab is using for, the one in Virginia is using that site for their lab investigation. So, yeah, that site in particular, but also not the ones that have slightly more privacy, at least in name, there's still the issue, can stuff be hacked from those sites, or, as I mentioned, the subpoenas. So just a bigger question of how smart is it to be uploading your DNA data to those sites, and that gets to the second question. Of course, this was a high-profile murder, multiple murder case, and burglaries and rapes, just gruesome stuff. But of course, as the woman at the ACLU wrote in her Washington Post op-ed, that's also on the ACLU site. I encourage people to read it. But I think that the issue there is this is, a more gruesome variety, but what about criminalization of more minor things that happen in our society as garden variety stuff, whether it's petty theft or, what have you. You can name just so many things that are now criminalized that maybe shouldn't be, that I think that if you thought about it for a while, the implications of it are that, these sites can be tapped into potentially for those things too. It's kind of unlikely that they would go to, you know, that far to put that much time and resources into something like that, you know, something very low level, but maybe there's something in between this very extreme and then that. So I think that just these, more than anything, this raises questions, and it raises questions about the bounds, raises questions about are the terms and conditions on these sites enough to protect the privacy of those who are using it? Should they expect more privacy than what they're getting? Because, as I said, basically the terms and conditions, at least on GED Match, say that there's quote-unquote other uses, and one of those uses that the site could be utilized for is law enforcement tapping into it. So, yeah, you said at early on that they kind of use deception, create an account, but at the same time, the terms and conditions basically say they're more or less allowed to do something like that. So the webs, you know, even though they weren't using it to find their family members, they're using it for a criminal probe, the terms and conditions say more or less they're allowed to do that. So it's a question of should that be allowed? We'll see. I don't know. Maybe some companies will take a stand and say, okay, our site's not going to be, we're not going to open up Pandora's box to that issue. Maybe we'll see new sites develop, as we've seen in the NSA era. We've seen some email sites that give more privacy, or search engines that give more privacy. So I just expect a lot of fallout from this from multiple angles and perspectives going forward.
Well, and I have serious concerns about mission creep here. And, I referenced Stingray. Originally, Stingray was deployed to investigate terrorism cases, and the FBI rolled it out to local law enforcement. They used it through the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, these vertically integrated law enforcement systems that have been enhanced since 9/11. They've also been given more legal authority from the Patriot Act and other acts of Congress. And the sum of it is that we're told that, you know, certain tactics, techniques, surveillance programs are all aimed at protecting us from dangerous terrorists from outside the country. But we've seen them mostly used to frame and roll up hapless suspects who were provoked into action by a paid FBI informant. And this formula, this script, has played out hundreds of times now. There are some 800 people who've been convicted of alleged domestic terrorism since 9/11. And Trevor Aronson, the journalist who has covered this beat most effectively, estimates that maybe a dozen of these are cases that are free of the taint of a paid informant, of wiretapping and surveillance that was used in a way to provoke a criminal act by somebody so they could be arrested and locked up. And so this use of DNA falls into the same area of concern for me, Steve.
I've written about one of those cases years ago, 2012, going through 2014, the NATO 5 case in Chicago, the Chicago Police Department and the FBI. And
I remember,
Security.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's the exact concern that was raised by the ACLU is what does this lead to? How can it be abused? How can it be reined in? How can it be, questions of, as we already discussed, how can it be used maybe for decent purposes, for criminal defense attorneys and fair criminal justice in the court system? So all sorts of issues, and then that arise from this. And then I would just want to mention one more thing is, the atmosphere of kind of a gung-ho, let's move forward with this, let's expand this. There's a law, the Justice Served Act, that I wrote about in my article. I don't think that this law has been mentioned at all in concert with what we're talking about now, except for in my article. And that particular bill passed in the House, a 377-1 vote. The one no vote was Justin Amash, who's a Republican, kind of a libertarian type in Michigan. That bill has all kinds of things in it, tough on crime stuff. But one of the prongs of it is to expand money, appropriations money, going from the Department of Justice to local law enforcement agencies to solve cold cases like this one. And I think that it's not really coincidental that at the same time as the Golden State Killer case has gotten a high profile and really big in the news, this particular piece of legislation is sailed through the House. I'm not really sure whether or not it will pass in the Senate, but it's being lobbied on by, as I mentioned, the article, the National District Attorneys Association, the National Sheriff's Association, the National Association of Police Organizations. Actually, the National Sheriff's Association isn't one of them, but several law enforcement and trade associations, more or less, have been lobbying on this at the federal level, and it did pass in the House almost unanimously.
Organizations.
One other thing is the Senate version of this bill already has 17 co-sponsors and is bipartisan. Obviously, mm-hmm. if something passes 377-1, it's extremely as bipartisan as it gets. So
yeah. We'll
see if it goes through the Senate or not, but it's still a kind of a signal that there is not a very critical line of thought going on about this issue in Congress, and that there is an atmosphere right now of expansion of these techniques rather than think critically about how we use them.
And the correct names of the organizations you were looking for: National District Attorneys Association, National Association of Police Organizations, Major County Sheriffs of America, and the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association. And, Steve, of course, we can take comfort that the great constitutionalist Jeff Sessions, as Attorney General, will be responsible for implementing this, and I'm sure he'll protect all of our rights.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Think about who this would be in the hands of, but even if it was, say we rewind and this was like 3-4 years ago, it'd still be equally concerning, even if
Indeed.
It was in the Obama era, because there'd be the question of Obama administration might be saying, well, look, we're going to put safeguards around this, blah, 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 blah. But there's still the issue of, does this open a Pandora's box for when, someone like a Trump administration gets into power? So, it's sort of a, we'll see. Yeah, I don't expect the Department of Justice to put too many protections around this, but at the same time, it's kind of interesting, as I said, that, I guess this is the Trump administration, so the Federal Trade Commission is at least doing some looking into whether or not two sites, Ancestry.com and 23andMe is the other one. They're looking into supposedly some issues around whether or not the consumers who use those sites were protected, because the FOIA request that I mentioned the Fast Company did, that was basically centered around what is the FTC doing about those issues, and they said they couldn't respond to the request because they have an ongoing investigation. And, there's still the chance that that means nothing, and they just use that exemption not to fork over records. It's hard to exactly say. They didn't confirm or deny anything in that particular article, so maybe the FTC is doing absolutely nothing about this, but mm-hmm. I guess it remains to be seen.
Well, Steve, I'm going to link to your article from Criminal Legal News in the show file for today's podcast, so listeners can peruse it in their own leisure time. And before you go, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that I'm really pleased that you have shifted your reporting skills into a different beat. Tell me a little bit about what motivated that. Did you kind of max out on climate change and tracking all of the pipelines in the United States?
I don't feel like I maxed out. I mean, I was a little bit tired of just covering so many pipelines and pipeline battles and all the various issues that arise with pipelines, whether it's climate change, environmental, water, or just, we've talked about on this show, corruption issues or things like that. But, I was just sort of a little bit tired of that. But, there's obviously way more to climate and environmental reporting than just covering pipelines. And I think that, in a way, I did it for 6.5 years, so I was a little bit, just generally a little bit tired of covering the beat, looking for something new. And this particular issue, criminal justice issues or constitutional issues, what have you, this is actually more along the lines of what I studied when I went to University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't study environmental studies or didn't really have a science background. So I think that was kind of, I learned as I went on that particular beat, and that was the first job basically that I got out of college.
Yeah.
What I studied in college was actually legal studies and political science, and legal studies I liked more. So legal studies is actually the sociology of our legal system, and you know, that's a very broad tent. But yeah, so these are just issues that have interested me for a long time. I mentioned already that I, on a freelance basis, I covered one high-profile, actually, it was a terrorism case in Chicago, but it was in criminal court there in Chicago, so the NATO 5 case. And so a little bit of experience, and I covered quite a bit of criminalization of pipeline protests already when I was working for a DSmog blog, and I was interested in getting more into that work. And so this job was open, and you know, I looked into their work and really respected what they did. And the other thing that I'll mention is about the environmental reporting and the environmental beat in the United States is, unfortunately, a lot of the work is kind of centered around the Democratic Party and kind of blaming a lot of stuff only on what the Republican Party has done, the climate change denial machine. And I think I was kind of unique in that I wrote a lot about what the Obama administration was doing from a very critical perspective, but it's a little hard to do. You know, there's cases in 2016 where I was frustrated because I couldn't do more and do more critically on Hillary Clinton, and I was forced more to cover things critically about the Trump campaign, and that has a lot to do with how environmental journalism in this country and more broadly environmental work through the NGOs is funded. It's funded by a lot of foundations that have close ties with Democratic Party, so you can't really be as critical. You have to be more carefully critical, I should say, of the Democrats. And so I was looking to kind of get out of that box.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. A lot of people aren't aware of it. And I have sensed it, but nobody has articulated it quite the way you just did.
I appreciate. I mean, it's just it's a reality, and you know, there's a lot of shared funding and different outlets. So, but yeah, it's something that I was continuously frustrated by, and luckily that Criminal Legal News and Prison Legal News and Human Rights Defense Center, a lot of our funding comes directly from subscriptions and advertising that in those particular magazines, which is advertising that's helpful to people who are incarcerated. 70% of our subscribers to Prison Legal News are actually incarcerated. So the other huge thing for me is I'm actually doing journalism that's helpful to the people who are most directly impacted by the issues. And so it's really nice in that way too. And you know, hopefully I can do work that sheds some light and serves as some form of information for those who need it.
Well, Steve, it was John Stauber, the co-founder of the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, who first introduced me to you. And I was impressed from the start. And I just want to say you're really moving in the right direction. You spent some time in Indianapolis. I grew up in Cincinnati, so I have an attitude about Indy. And I'm very glad to welcome you to the Golden State of California, where you have landed in San Diego. And I follow your daily running exploits on Facebook.
Getting back in shape, yeah, trying to.
Well, Steve, thanks for this report, and I look forward to many more.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me back on, and look forward to coming back on in the future.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with journalist Steve Horn. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.